Let's go ahead and have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:35 on the afternoon. Actually, 1:30. I said 1:35, but it meant 1:30. 1:30 in the afternoon of Wednesday, February 16th, 2011. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Pascan, myself, Senator French, and Senator Olakowski, the Vice Chair. And we have several bills on our docket today. SB 58, Superior Court Judges, SB 72, Stalking Minors Information, and so forth, SB 11, Hate Crimes, SB 39, Presidential Election Compact. For the listening public, I'm hoping to move SB 58 out of committee today, hoping to finish the walkthrough of the sectional on SB 72 from the administration, and hoping to introduce both SB 11 and SB 39 just to get them in front of the committee. So with that, let's turn first to SB 58. We discussed this at some length during the last committee hearing. This bill increases the number of Superior Court judges by two. We closed by having a lengthy and spirited discussion about how we arrange our family courts. I've made that a personal project of mine to do more investigation into that subject. I've collected a couple hundred pages of fascinating reading to go through. I'm not sure that this bill is the proper vehicle to do that in, so I think for the time being we'll let this bill go on and then take up the family court issue in a different venue. And I encourage the members of the committee to reach out to any judges you may know and talk to them about it informally and get their input, because that's obviously something very valuable on that topic. So we do have SB 58 in front of us. Any committee discussion, amendments, concerns? Hearing and seeing none, I would solicit a motion to move the bill. Senator Olakowski.
Chair, I would move that we move Senate Bill 58 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. Let's take a short IDs for the paperwork. Now we're back on the record. Thank you. Great. We are back on the record. And next up is the administration's bill, SB 72. We had an overview on the bill a week or so ago, and we never got quite through it. We got a lot of spirited discussion. Ms. Carpinetti, welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. And if someone told you where we left off, that'd be helpful, or we can direct you to where my committee aide is. Let me know that it was we'd finished Section 7, and we're now ready to have you take up Section 8 of the bill. So welcome.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And I'll just go finish the sectional, and that's
please,
what you want to hear.
Please,
today.
Please.
Section 8 is a conforming amendment to clarify that the provisions in the sexting section are not included as part of the provisions in the harassment section of the statute. Here we are. Section 9 clarifies the crime of distribution of indecent material to minors, which was worked on quite extensively last year in the legislature. And what it does is it simply clarifies the culpable mental state for persons who that the state must, has to prove in order to convict a person of the offense. It would generally be read into the statute, but we're in the middle of a lawsuit that challenging some of the changes that were made last year. And one of the things that has been suggested that would clarify the statute would be write the culpable mental states in, even though there's a general provision in our statutes directing us what to read in if there's nothing spoken there. So it provides that the person must know that the material depicts particular conduct, and that the person who is charged must be reckless as to the age of the child to whom he or she is sending the material.
And if Ms. Carpinetti, if we make those changes, will they drop the lawsuit?
I wish I could say yes. We're still talking to them about there's, in fact, we just received some suggestions from them a couple days ago. But I don't think this, they have told us that these help, but they don't go far enough in their opinion.
Senator Pascan has a question.
You know, again, I don't practice criminal law, so I don't understand it, but where it talks about the person knows, and then part of the standard is lewd touching or just lewd exhibition. Mm-hmm. What's the difference, but why is the word lewd in there as an adjective as compared to just knows that it depicts the touching or the exhibition? What's the mental status as far as the word lewd?
That would be a circumstance. I think it would be reckless. The culpable mental state, the lewd. What the person has to know is that the material contains the following material, the following pictures of the following acts. And I'm sorry, the person would have to know that the material included the lewd touching of a person's genitals.
And I'm not understanding what the word lewd is meaning in that context. I understand that if it depicts the touching or the exhibition of those areas or those acts, that it's defined by lewd. What does the lewd mean
what
in that
mean?
Context?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavin, that is not defined in our statutes. That's a question for a jury, that term.
Okay.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this bill apply to cartoon characters, for instance? I wouldn't think so, but I just want that for the record.
You said you would think so?
I wouldn't think so.
Through the chair, no, it does not.
Okay.
And just for the record, while we're on this section, I have, and maybe you all have received, a letter dated today from the American Civil Liberties Union, from Jeff Mittman, speaking about this specific section, pointing out that specific section has had an injunction granted against it, so to speak, on First Amendment grounds. Mr. Mittman goes on to say that Section 9 of the bill before us would narrow 1161-128 to only criminalize the distribution of material harmful to minors by an adult if the recipient is under 16 and the adult is reckless regarding the recipient's age, much as Ms. Carpinetti just described. Mr. Mittman goes on to say that the bill is an improvement on the statutes as it was enjoined, but even with these changes, the law would still violate the First Amendment and Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Although Mr. Mittman does not recommend any specific changes, I'm assuming you're in communication with him on this topic.
Mr. Chairman, we're in communication with Michael Bamberger, who is an attorney who's working with this group of litigants. I have not personally been in communication with Mr. Mittman himself, but I have spoken to him.
Okay. I mean, I hate to sort of turn to the ACLU and have them write the statute. On the other hand, they did win an injunction. So I guess at some point we need to figure out how far we can go and no further.
Well, I can tell you that the case right now is there have been motions for summary judgment filed by both sides, and we're waiting to hear from the court what the court's opinion is.
Very good. And how long have those motions been pending? Do you know?
I don't know, but I can find
out. Okay. It's just a curiosity.
It's really recent.
Will they be decided before the end of the session?
Oh, no, I can't tell you that.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I also don't practice criminal law. So one of the questions that I had that might be easy to explain is the person is under 16 years old, without the amended language, my expectation is that they somehow knew that that person was under 16. And then the reckless disregard of that is, or the reckless regard of that is the next next line of proof?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it would require the state to prove that either the child was under 16 years of age and the person who was distributing the material is reckless as to that fact. So reckless is defined in our statutes as a high probability, knowing that there's a high probability that the person would be under 16 and knowingly disregarding that risk.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that was kind of my question, is if it seemed to me like if they knew that they were under 16, if it was presumed that they knew they was under 16, then it would be a disregard of that information. I think, and so I was just trying to think of why reckless regard would be put there instead of absolutely ignoring the fact, disregard. I'm just curious if that's even a term of art.
It's almost a reverse what common sense would suggest. That is, this is easier to prove than intentional, right? Right. Ms. Carpinetti.
This is really one of the cruxes of the lawsuit, I think, that some people believe that the state would have to prove that the person who's distributing this material knows that the person is under 16. We use the culpable mental state of reckless disregard because it's a lower culpable mental state, but it still requires the state to prove that the person knew of a substantial risk that the person was under 16 years of age and knowingly disregarded that risk.
Mr. Chairman, I'm only guessing that's because of the ability of people to get false IDs and lie.
I'm going to guess it's even less. How often do you ask for identification from anyone that you deal with, communicate with, send emails to, have in your home, transport in your car? And yet, at some level, we all sort of have a general idea of how old people are, mm-hmm. By their appearance, their demeanor, whether they're in school, what grade of school they're in, and so forth.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I was just in the office with somebody who's 26, and she looked like a teenager to me. Maybe I'm just getting old.
It is a factor of our age group. Other comments on this thorny section, Senator Wilkowski.
What was the court's rationale for saying this violated the First Amendment?
Through the chair, I have not read what the judge wrote when he enjoined the enforcement of this section, but I will provide it for you. And I think it was the chilling effect, the possible chilling effect on sending material.
If you'd send a copy to my office as well, I would take a look at it. I'm curious now.
Happy to.
Thank you. Does the whole committee interested?
Please.
Okay. Five copies, please.
Sure.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter.
And I think I have read it, but it's been
a while. Yeah.
It's been a while, so I would hate to describe
sure.
it at this point.
Okay.
Section 10 adds two new statutes to the criminal code dealing with misconduct involving confidential information. And this is not specific to children, but it fits in with the theme of new technologies and using new technologies to victimize people. The second degree contains the crux of the crime, and that is if a person, and the reason that this came to our attention was information about merchants who will ask for a driver's license for no apparent reason and will scan it. And from that strip on a driver's license, you can get a social security number and you get various other information. And then using it to sell or to, in some cases, commit crimes. And that, coupled with new technologies where a person can be walking down the street and with certain equipment can, if you get close enough to another person's satchel or backpack or purse, get material from their credit cards from a person's purse. We thought it would be a reasonable thing to make it at least a lower level crime at this point to get confidential information from the person without their consent, knowingly obtain confidential information. And confidential information is defined as information that is defined as confidential by law. So there are various statutes in our laws defining certain information as confidential, like, for example, certain employment information, absent information. I have a pile of statutes that specifically provide that this information is confidential.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
You started to hit on exactly what I was going to ask. And if you do have a list of those things that would be considered confidential, I would be interested in seeing that.
I'll be happy to.
And then is that intended to apply to classified confidential by federal law, state law? Is there a separation there?
It doesn't specify. I would read it as broadly. But that would probably be something that would be good to think about and maybe decide how far you wanted to define it.
Senator Pascan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the public that's watching might be interested in, you know, I didn't know that someone could just by walking by you or alongside you access your credit card or other information directly from that. Is there any way that one could be proactive is there a product that shields the ability of the wrongdoer to steal it?
Through the chair, Senator Pascan, I have heard that there are women who put lead liners on the outside of their purse or around the outside of their purse to avoid that possibility. That's the only one I've heard so far.
Wow. Yeah. Senator McGuire.
So, through the chair, I dealt with this particular issue a few years ago when I introduced this little bill that was meant to be a consumer protection bill, and I wanted to know if it would apply in this scenario that would inform consumers if RFID chips were being used in their little cars cards and things like that. Because what I was finding out is that as they were walking into grocery stores, information, confidential information about them was in fact being detected and monitored and recorded, and then they were getting coupons and solicitations as a result of their buying habits and even their walking habits through the stores. And the bill ended up not advancing because by the time the committee room, it wasn't this committee room at the time, was full of all the people in the state that were affected by RFID chips. In terms of movement of goods, trucking, shipment, modality. I mean, it was unbelievable, the constituency that lined up against the bill saying, if you put this into law and you make it illegal for us to obtain this information without the consent of the consumer, I don't know what we're going to do. And, of course, my answer at the time was, well, let them know. You know, let them know and then get their consent. The Chamber of Commerce opposed it. The petroleum industry opposed it, everybody else. And so I guess I just want to know if the department has really thought through all those scenarios in which that information would be obtained and whether we're going to be filling our courthouses prosecuting a whole lot of people for this particular crime.
Well, through the chair, Senator McGuire, I will definitely go back and get the minutes on that.
Okay.
And make sure that we have thought through them all, because when you say RFID, you mean radio frequency
identification.
Okay. I will do that. I think that we have thought through some scenarios, but probably not as many as you describe.
I remember that bill.
It'll blow your mind.
It was very warm. Definitely very warm. Senator Wilkowski.
Well, I had a slightly different bill involving biometrics, because protecting a person's fingerprints, retinal scans, DNA. Actually, I think DNA is already protected. Is that something that we could classify as confidential in here as well?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, in our statutes, there are certain health records that are confidential. And I guess I would have to look at the specifics. I do recall that bill.
Yeah.
I could find out. Okay. or check into it.
Thank you.
The second degree, the first degree provision, which is a Class A misdemeanor, the basic crime would be a Class B misdemeanor. The first degree offense would be taking that confidential information and either using it to commit a crime or to obtain a benefit. And benefit is defined in our statutes rather broadly.
Um,
Section 11 of the bill is a statement about jurisdiction, prosecution's jurisdiction over two different crimes. One would be online enticement of a minor, and the sexting provision that's in the bill. We think our jurisdiction statute now would probably cover these, but we thought that for these offenses, which are, you know, could be committed anywhere in the world, actually, against victims in our state, we wanted to clarify that that we can prosecute if it's practical to do so.
Thank you.
Section 12 amends the sentencing statutes for sex crimes to conform with the increases that have already been discussed in the first part of the bill. I understand you already discussed this last week, that raised online enticement to a Class A felony and raised unlawful exploitation of a minor to a Class A felony.
We did. Senator Pascman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible with technology to detect the equipment that the wrongdoer would be carrying, for example, on the street? And if so, wouldn't it be important to draft a law saying that if we catch someone carrying this stuff on the street, even if we haven't proved that they've stolen something? And I don't know whether that's, you know,
it's like possession of burglary tools.
Yeah. Right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Thought about, you know, possession of burglary tools. I guess you'd have to consider, through the chair, Senator Pascman, you probably have to consider whether this equipment could be used in any legitimate way. If it could, it would be difficult to prove that. I mean, it would have to be some sort of specific intent crime. I'd have to think about that.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You know, if they have a legitimate purpose to have this device that can lift confidential information just because they're walking by you on the street, mm-hmm. I mean, it's the people that would have access to that equipment that I think society should be most worried about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they got a legit reason for having it, fine. But if they don't have a legit reason, I think the presumption would be pretty straightforward that mm-hmm. they're out there stealing the stuff to use against society.
Mm-hmm.
The poor Department of Law has to do all this work. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Ms. Carpinetti, just dovetailing into that, I agree, and it reminds me of Oregon as one example of a state where it's illegal to possess a radar detector. Mm-hmm. Irrespective of whether or not you are using it or not, it's illegal to possess one because the presumption is that you're going to be using it to detect the presence of a police officer who's ultimately enforcing your speed. And so we might look at that as one example as well. And then secondly, maybe it could be drafted with a rebuttable presumption in mind that says that if you possess it, it's a crime, and there's a rebuttable presumption that says that you can prove there's a legitimate reason for which you would have this equipment. But I think that's a great idea.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you define unlawful exploitation on page 7, line 9?
Which section are we back to?
Section.
Here we go. Okay.
11.
Yep.
12.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
How are you defining unlawful exploitation?
It's the crime that's in 1141-455 is unlawful exploitation of a minor. It might be in this. No, it's not. And that is basically the creation of child pornography.
Okay. And while you were not present during the last presentation, but I asked Mr. Wolliver about how often we're prosecuting both online enticement and unlawful exploitation. I don't remember his answer right off the top of my head. Maybe my staff does. Do you remember what the answer was regarding how often those statutes get used?
Should be in your binder.
If I can find the answer. Oh, here we go. Yep. Thank you. It is in my binder.
I got it, too.
Oh, you got it. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and testify to that?
Chairman, Mr. Wolliver said that there were seven cases filed under 1141-455.
That's unlawful exploitation?
Yes. Yep. In last year, and four cases of online enticement of a minor.
So 7 and 4?
Right.
Not
many cases.
Yeah, not many cases. And that's that's at least one of the questions that the bill raises in my mind, which is, you know, why don't we give them life sentences? I mean, if it's, I guess I'm sort of saying, if we're not prosecuting very many, does it really make a big difference to make it a more serious crime? If we were getting a wave of these and we thought, gee, maybe a more serious penalty would have some effect out in the world. But, I mean, that's a scant number of prosecutions when you compare to, for example, the number of sex assaults you prosecute, which is, you know, probably this many every day. Mm-hmm. So I'm just I'm a little concerned about, you know, jacking the penalties up on a crime that we rarely prosecute. But that's just me.
Well, the cases are pretty serious.
And, oh, yes.
And I could, I think Sergeant DeGraff is not here today, but he will be in the future. And on the other side, he was prepared to testify as to some of the cases that we do prosecute, and they're pretty shocking.
I could not agree more. Last year, he made a good presentation to us, and last year, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, and myself visited their headquarters, for lack of a better word, and watched some of the online activities they engage in to grab these criminals. So there's no question that it is not a very serious crime.
It's just our position that they are serious enough to justify these penalties for themselves, mm-hmm. even though they may not. There may not be a huge
very many of them that we're getting.
But the ones themselves that we are able to get a conviction on or justify as serious things.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coghill,
just on that point, maybe those number of small cases have other charges that go along with them, kidnapping, things like that. Is there any knowledge of that?
Through the chair, I did ask. It was in conjunction with child kidnapping. So I checked with the sexual SORNA office in Alaska, sex offender registration, and at least in terms of child kidnapping, most of them have sexual assaults, too. And I suspect it's the same with these, but I will find out.
The reason I was saying that is I agree with you, but it looks to me like generally from what I've heard and sitting in these committees is that this is one of many infractions on society.
Crimes that someone's committing. Yep. Senator McGuire.
And, Mr. Chairman, I think what, if I'm correct, I heard you implying in part in your question is if the notion that we adopted years ago, which is three strikes are out, essentially, in sex offense, recognizing that the rehabilitation rate is very low for sex offenders and that we would go ahead and say 99 years. I think what I heard maybe you saying is that should we just make it a life sentence by that third time, and I'm wondering if that's what you meant, rather than carving out an additional increase.
No.
Okay.
Would these continue? And that's the section we were just on, in fact, is the section that incorporates these crimes into the three strikes scheme.
Yeah, right.
And so they would still, you know, whether they're C, B, or A felonies, they're going to be three strikes type crimes.
Okay.
It's, in fact, you'll notice if you go to page 2, we've long had a two strikes scheme on unlawful exploitation. It was a Class B on the first offense, Class A on the second. If we make it a Class A, there's certainly no need to make the second one a Class A. The second one's going to be essentially an unclassified, I guess, and be, is that right, eligible for a 99-year sentence on the second offense?
I think we'd have to say that in the statute. Right now,
so the first one would be an A, the second one would be an A, and the third one would be the third strike.
Yes. Okay. And one thing I should clarify, when we were looking at these changes in Title 12, unlawful exploitation of a minor, which is the creation of this material, is already in this section, Section I of our felony sentencing provisions. But online enticement of a minor, for some reason that I didn't understand, was left out of
The three strikes.
Okay. And it's a serious enough offense that we grouped it with the other similar Class A felonies or Class B felonies. And under this bill, the first offense or If you're not required to register as a sex offender and you commit this crime, it would be a Class B felony. So it appears in two places on these pages for sentencing.
Yeah, I guess I'll just say again by way of general comment, the online enticement, and this is something we'll take up with Sergeant DeGraff at some point, but, you know, we've seen presentations in committee rooms, I know, in this building many times about the huge sort of prevalence of this, not so much online enticement, but, you know, the transmission of child pornography, for example, in Alaska, and the chat rooms and so forth. That's certainly what we saw when we visited the headquarters, you know, the sort of shocking messages that are sent back and forth between people who either believe they're talking to a child or maybe talking to a child, you know, enticing them into sexual acts, and it's horrific. I mean, I mean, no one can look at that and not be just shocked at what's happening. And so I guess the resources we're pouring into it and the level of activity you see would suggest you'd see more than four prosecutions a year. And I'm not saying you guys aren't doing your job. I'm just surprised that that's such a small number.
Mm-hmm. It is surprising.
Right.
And hopefully we'll be doing better.
Sure. Sure. I know there's an issue with respect to the subpoena power, the expanded subpoena power we tried to grant last year. We need to come back and fix. And perhaps is that going to be brought in this bill, do you think? Or
yes.
Something you're working on to put into a CS at some future date.
Yes.
Yes.
And I didn't. I asked the aide and your aide, who said that probably wouldn't get to it today. But,
okay.
But
we certainly will, because I know the committee is going to be interested in that.
Yeah.
So that brings us more or less to the end of the bill, unless you have something else for us, Ms. Carpinetti.
Well, unless you wanted me to just explain Section 13, which
let's take a look.
It deals with probation officers.
Yes, please, please.
Under current law, our statutes say that the Commissioner of Corrections is required to provide probation officers to the Superior Court, and this doesn't change that. In the past, we've unfortunately never been able to have supervised probation of misdemeanors. But the Department of Corrections is experimenting with a program. And I think it's in Anchorage, and they're thinking about trying it in Fairbanks. But it's called the PACE program, and it provides pretty serious supervision of certain misdemeanor defendants, which is great to see for these experimental programs. However, we want to make it clear that as good an idea as it would be for every misdemeanor probationer, that courts can't be ordering it because they simply don't have resources for it. So this section just clarifies that that idea.
Any questions about Section 13? Don't see any. Thank you. I appreciate the overview. It's a lengthy bill with lots of different aspects to it. We will hold it in committee for the time being, and we do have two folks signed up to testify besides you, Ms. Carpinetti. Thank you. Tony Newman's here. Ms. Newman, were you wanting to make a statement, or were you here to answer questions?
I'm here to answer questions. I have a few observations about the bill from the Juvenile Justice.
Please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Like all of you and like Alaskans generally at the Division of Juvenile Justice, we're concerned about the way communications technology and social media are developing so fast that they're outpacing our ability to fully understand how they impact young people. Mm-hmm. Several of the offenses that are the focus of this bill are committed by predatory adults toward children, but as many of as you have noted, the offenses in this bill can also be committed by unthinking and impulsive kids who do something that they think is little more than a prank or that is just between friends, but which can have very long-term and damaging consequences for victims. So we appreciate this attempt by the governor and the Department of Law to try and get ahead of these issues before they run over too many lives and reputations. Alaska has a juvenile justice system that recognizes that minors can and should be managed differently than adults. Our division's mission is to hold youth accountable when they commit offenses, but also to provide them with opportunities to keep them from continuing to make mistakes. This bill amends and increases charge classes for a couple of offenses, but it strikes a balance, and it still allows the division to respond to the juvenile in a way that's appropriate, given their risks to reoffend and any needs they may have. For example, the bill continues to allow the division to respond to a youth who may commit offenses by referring the youth to a diversion program, such as a youth court, without requiring that they go through formal court proceedings for the offense. The one exception to that is the has been identified by Mrs. Carpinetti regarding the increase in charge class level 4 unlawful exploitation of a minor. Class A felonies against a person are what's known to us in the juvenile justice system as auto waiver offenses or automatic transfer offenses. What that means is that when a 16 or 17-year-old commits a Class A felony against a person, they never enter the juvenile justice system at all, but are instead referred directly to the adult criminal justice system. And while we believe that unlawful exploitation of a minor is a serious offense, when it is committed by a juvenile, it would be counterproductive to automatically waive that juvenile into the adult system. So the Department of Law has agreed and is working with us to craft an amendment to the bill that we'll have for you, I suppose, at a future date. So those were the observations about the bill I wanted to make from a juvenile justice perspective, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
No, but I appreciate the timely testimony, and we'll keep it under consideration and look forward to the amendment.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Also, here's Quinlan Steiner from the Public Defender Agency. Mr. Steiner, welcome to the committee. It's nice to have you here in person and not on the telephone. Not that we don't love hearing your voice on the telephone, but it's easier to pay attention to you when you're right here in the room.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I'd like to put just a couple comments on the bill, on the record. They relate to Section 7. They relate to what I think are unintended consequences of the language in that bill. They kind of primarily cover two topics. One is the breadth of the nature of how it's defined. Essentially, this bill would cover relationships, say couples that are taking photographs of each other and sending them to each other, high school kids primarily. So say girlfriend takes a picture of boyfriend and emails it to the boyfriend, that would actually be a violation of the statute. And I'm not sure that was intended by the language of this bill. It would also cover things much broader. Photographs were taken by grandparents of their grandkids and then sent to their friends or posted on Facebook or something like that. That would be criminalized by the statute. So the language as written is quite broad in that respect. It's really not limited to the situations what I think are intended, which is the distribution where to broader groups that have likelihood of embarrassing or harassing an individual who's a subject. I think there is language that could clean that up, especially with regard to couples. It could be limited to, there could be an exclusion for folks that are taking the pictures or involved in the picture. And that's one concern I have about an unintended consequence. The other concern relates to the C felony nature of the conduct. You see on subsection that deals with penalties, the Class C felony, if the person publishes or distributes the depiction on the internet, and then it later refers to the definition of internet. Internet is defined quite broadly, and in fact includes the physical nature of the internet and how things are transferred. And because phones use email and instant messaging and things that travel on the internet, if you were actually to take a photograph and email it to one person, which would normally be a misdemeanor in the statute, it would in fact become a felony. So it essentially would have to felonize most of the conduct, unless you actually use a printed photograph to do your publishing and distribution. I think what was intended by that section was posting, on the internet for public viewing, rather than simple distribution. I think it's just a technical problem. It does encompass that. And so those are the two areas I have of concern with regard to that section. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that or other aspects.
I don't know if you listened into our first hearing on this bill, but we probably spent a half an hour really digging into the details of this. It's very difficult. It's you know, the whole issue of criminalizing the behavior, how, you know, what the target behavior is that we're trying to eliminate, and all the attendant behavior that, while is unseemly, may not be criminal. And so it's certainly, and I appreciate you testifying, but I can just tell you that it's something the committee is really focused on is how do we get at this without getting too much. Questions for Mr. Steiner? Don't see any. Thanks again for being here. With that, we have completed an overview of the bill, and as it is complex and lengthy and it's a work in progress, we will set it aside for the time being. But thanks, everyone, for helping get it to this point. And then next up is SB 11. I see the bill sponsors. Staff are here. Mr. Obermeyer, welcome. And when the committee's ready and you're ready, go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us an overview of SB 11.
For the record, I'm Tom Obermeyer, assistant to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill 11. The draft is 27LS0087A as an alpha. It increases the sentencing for crimes motivated by prejudice, bias, or hatred. This bill increases the sentencing for crimes motivated by prejudice, bias, or hatred based on the victim's race, sex, color, creed, physical or mental disability, sexual orientation, gender identity, ancestry, or national origin. This new crime can only be committed when a person commits some underlying crime and the person directed the conduct constituting the crime at a victim due to one of the listed characteristics of the victim. The new crime increases the classification of the underlying crime one level. Without creating a new list of hate crimes, in quotes, under AS 11.76, new section 11.76.150 simply reclassifies the level of any crime up one notch if motivated by prejudice, bias, or hatred based on the victim's race, sex, color, creed, physical or mental disability, sexual orientation, gender identity, ancestry, or national origin. For example, a Class B misdemeanor becomes a Class A misdemeanor, a Class A misdemeanor becomes a C felony becomes a B felony, etc. Such reclassification, of course, increases the penalties appropriate to the classification and sentencing under Alaska Statute 12.55. The bill also amends Alaska Statute, this is a typo, 12.55.155C22, an aggravating factor as sentencing for felonies by adding, in quotes, sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of protected characteristics. The need for this bill is demonstrated by increasing reports of violence against homeless persons, minorities, religious groups, and others motivated by prejudice, bias, or hatred in Alaska and across the country in our highly diverse and multicultural society. When crimes are committed because of a person's differences, the effects reverberate beyond a single victim or group into an entire community, city, state, and society as a whole. While this bill alone cannot eliminate prejudice, bias, or hatred, it will send a message that Alaskans will not tolerate hate crimes in any form, and sentencing for them will be substantially increased. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I've seen this bill many times, Mr. Obermeyer, so I don't have any questions. I just appreciate you and the sponsor bringing it before us. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Obermeyer. Have you had an opportunity to read the letter from the ACLU dated February 16th of this year?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I did read it, and I've spoken with Mr. Mittman since then. And I tried to reply. And I also talked to Jerry Luckhoff, who is the drafter of this bill, and Mr. Luckhoff, who is in, I understand, the House Judiciary Committee at this moment, would be happy to explain it. But, and I'm not suggesting this committee can't change the bill as it sees fit. Basically, Mr. Mittman, as I understand it, is concerned that this language doesn't conform to the language in the Matthew Shepard bill, the federal bill, that gave a little more definition to what we're doing here. Our drafter didn't feel it was necessary because most of this comes under character rule of evidence, 404. He felt that it was adequately defined and understood by all of our prosecutors, that it's worked well in the past, and that it would be unnecessary to add this language. There is a difference of opinion by the ACLU on this issue. I don't really have an answer. Maybe the drafter could better address it. I know that Senator French has dealt with this issue many times as a former prosecutor. But absent additional information from the lawyers that deal with this, and I would suggest the Department of Law as well, I don't know that I could really suggest a change at this moment.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair. In part, the letter from the ACLU does discuss adopting the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act language with respect to the rules of construction, and I like it because I think that it keeps things consistent. But what I was also looking for comment on is the page 2 commentary at the bottom, which I think really gets to the heart of the First Amendment, which delineates between two situations where you would be offering evidence. And that's the case where, and these are difficult to describe because, frankly, racism is repugnant, absolutely. And we don't support it in our state. We don't support it in our country. However, we do protect people's right to speak and to freely associate as they choose, and it's a delicate balance. And so the language that the ACLU is proposing is saying that rather than leaving it as broad as it is, fearing that it will be thrown out by the Supreme Court of Alaska for being overly broad and vague, that rather you say in a prosecution for an offense under this section, evidence of expression or associations of the defendant may not be introduced as substantive evidence at trial unless the evidence specifically relates to that offense. However, nothing in this section affects the rules of evidence governing the impeachment of a witness. And that doesn't relate to anything in 404, and I understand what you're saying about character evidence, but I think the question is that if you end up in a circumstance where a person's, and we deal with this in rape trials, frankly, a person's character themselves goes on trial, and the fact that they were once a member of the Communist Party or once a member of the, unfortunately, some of these associations that we find repugnant is introduced as evidence, if you will, to escalate, to elevate that crime to a higher level, I would, too, be concerned about that. However, if you did have a circumstance where a person said in the course of committing that crime, I'm committing this crime against you, or leaving a note or doing something that made a public display about the fact that they were attacking this person in a violent way, in a way that we find reprehensible because of their race, that's different. And I just wanted to know if you'd had a chance to read that part of the opinion as well and what your thought was.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I have read it. I did speak to Mr. Luckhoff about it, and his view is that it would seem somewhat unnecessary that he had in fact felt that that this language is dealt with every day by the prosecutors, and that we've been successful even with our current definition of aggravation under that subsection 22 on the last page to deal with offenses that go beyond what we're doing. But on this particular wording, I'm trying to remember the terms that he used, and it'd be better if he were here, that he felt it was not redundant but unnecessary to add additional language because the areas that we're dealing with here are dealt with our current rules of evidence. And nothing changes that. This, in his view, this bill does not increase change or improve or override, I should say, the rules of evidence. Now, I'm not suggesting that this committee couldn't add words here, but I would ask that you might want to get additional information not only from Mr. Luckhout, but perhaps also from the Department of Law before you change what has been done for a long time. What we were trying to change here was the definitional aggravators, including sexual orientation and gender identity in subsection 22, without really addressing these additional associational rights that frankly, every time I come up with an explanation an example, as you did, it's difficult because I think when I emailed back today that I suggested that if a person has the association with the Ku Klux Klan or dislikes black people or others in general, that might not be admissible. But on the other hand, if you tie it to additional statements that they've made situations, that evidence together might be admissible. I think we saw the situation where this whole issue of the hate crimes came up in Anchorage a number of years back with the paintballing of natives and it was youth that attacked just that those particular individuals. Well, they could have made statements, as I would understand the application here, that they don't, we'll say they don't like natives. But if they say they don't like natives, I'm going to go out and I'm going to shoot everyone I see with a paintball gun. That connects the association of that individual with that particular crime. So there's always an underlying crime. In this particular instance, we're trying to ratchet it up if we can prove motive. I think Senator French has indicated that even in the best of circumstances, proving motive can be very difficult for a prosecutor. And so there has to be a good deal of evidence involved in this particular crime that we're dealing with.
Mr. Obermeyer, thank you. And we do have several witnesses lined up to testify, including Mr. Mittman. And I would also welcome the opportunity to hear from Mr. Luckup before the bill leaves committee. So I think we'll have a good array of advice before we take final action. Further questions for the bill's sponsor? Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it. Let's turn to public testimony. We've got several people lined up to testify, and I'd like to get to them today. Let's start with Slade Martin. Slade Martin, if you can hear my voice, go ahead and tell me your name and your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Hello, my name is Slade Martin. I'm 22 years old and a resident of Palmer, Alaska. I'm speaking on behalf and in favor of Senator Betty Davis's bill on hate crimes. I was just in Juneau 2 weeks ago for the Youth Policy Summit, which is where I got introduced to this bill and was immediately intrigued. I think buckling down on the consequences for individuals who commit acts of hate based on any of the protected clauses is an amazing idea. I believe doing so will send a message to all of Alaska, maybe even the United States, that we care about our citizens and we don't take these kind of instances softly. It will also tell them that we care about the safety of our residents, our community, and our state. I believe perpetrators of hate crimes will be less likely to recommit or commit in the first place. As it stands, a hate crime can be deemed a misdemeanor, and the perpetrator may only get a slap on the wrist in community service. If we were to up the punishment, he or she may think twice before attacking a fellow man, and it may also give the victim a sense of safety, justice, and trust back in our legal system. Nobody likes to be victimized. Victims often feel confused, self-hatred, alone, scared, and oftentimes suicidal. I think passing this bill may also be a step towards suicide prevention, which, as we all know, is a big issue in the state. I'm sure everyone is aware of the teen bullying epidemic based on sexual orientation in this country, where suicide has been an unfortunate end result. I have personally experienced hate in my life based on my own sexual orientation. And I can tell you firsthand, I felt all the emotions I listed above and some. I've been beaten up while I was sleeping. I've had a hot iron taken to my face, name-calling, etc. In addition, I've had several acquaintances who have also experienced similar events. As people are becoming introduced at a growing rate to violence, and the views that it is okay continue, I fear for myself, my loved ones, our community, and our future generations. Therefore, this is why I feel very strongly about this topic. Thank you very much.
Mr. Martin, thank you for testifying. I don't see any questions for you. We also have Shale Hutchinson. Hutchison, I'm sorry, in Fairbanks.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my comments. I am Shale Hutchison, and I'm a board member of a group called Alaskans Together for Equality. And I'm speaking here today to urge you to support Senate Bill 11 and to move it forward. I believe that passing this legislation, that increasing penalties for crimes based on bias or prejudice, is a way to increase the safety of Alaskan residents and increase the sense of justice that Alaskan communities will have. When someone is assaulted, the fear, the oppression that they feel, the trauma that they feel, all of those experiences are felt by an individual. But the reason why for crimes that are based on bias, that it's really important that we increase those penalties is because a hate crime affects not just an individual, but an entire group of people. So now you have a whole group of people that are experiencing those same effects of trauma, the same effects of oppression, that same effect of fear. And when you have such a large group of people that are affected by that, it really changes the dynamics of how a community functions. It changes how people interact in public places. It changes whether or not people will decide to go into a public place or how they walk down the street or how they are able to express themselves. And apart from the psychological impact, there's another safety aspect that means that hate crimes really do deserve these increased penalties. And that's because once you have a crime of violence that's based on bias or prejudice, you are increasing the likelihood or the opportunity of a retaliation attack, and then a counter-retaliation attack. So that ripple effect of violence is something that's going to come in wave after wave and not end in the community unless the legislature is able to send a strong message that these kinds of crimes will not be tolerated. I particularly appreciate the addition of sexual orientation and gender identity to this legislation. I really believe that in Alaska, we need to send a message that you have an absolute right to believe what you want to believe and to hold the values that you hold. But no one in Alaska has a right to impose their beliefs or values on somebody else using violence, coercion, oppression, or fear. And I think that moving this bill forward or supporting this bill is going to pass that message. As Senator McGuire so eloquently said, it is a delicate balance between making sure that we are protecting somebody's freedom of expression, but what we're really talking about here is using violence, using something that is against the law to impose your own beliefs on someone else. And I don't think that that's something in Alaska that we should tolerate. Thank you very much for hearing my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Hutchinson. I appreciate you taking time to come tell us your views. We also have Beth Trimmer. Beth Trimmer from the Office of Public Advocacy.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here only to answer questions on the fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you. We will go on then to Nelson Angapek.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Go ahead and give us your name for the record, your affiliation, and we'll be listening carefully to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Nelson Angapek, Senior Vice President, Alaska Federation of Natives. Earlier today, we sent our written statement to Betty Davis's office, and we request that our written statement, along with its attachment dealing with hate issues on radio, be incorporated into the record of this hearing. Mr. Chairman, I propose a moment of silence. A minute. Chairman, the reason for asking this is that 66 years ago, in February 1945, when the Territorial Senate met as a committee of the whole, we met to discuss equal rights and a bill that would prohibit racial discrimination in Alaska. Many of the territorial senators spoke out against equal rights at the committee, refusing to recognize that there was a problem. One of the customs of the time was that the people that were attending these kind of hearings were also allowed to speak on the bills. For many of you, one of the heroes that us Alaska Natives look to is Elizabeth Peredovich. She was present as a representative from the Alaska Native Sisterhood, and she was a final speaker of the day. She opened her statement by saying, about prejudice and injustice by saying, I would not have expected that I, who am barely out of savagery, would have to remind the gentleman with 5,000 years of recorded civilization behind them of our Bill of Rights as contained in the United States Constitution. Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Federation of Natives fully supports elevating the punishment for hate crimes committed based on our race, color, and everything else identified in the bill. We are hoping that such elevation for these crimes committed might act as a deterrent for committing such crimes. You know, we could continue, but in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, we urge the committee to report Senate Bill 11 out of the committee, and once it reaches the Alaska State Senate floor, we are urging that the members of this committee to speak strongly for a favorable consideration by the full Senate of SB 11. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. That concludes our statement on Senate Bill 11.
Mr. Engelbach, thank you. Here in Juneau, we have Kate Burkhart. Kate Burkhart, welcome to the committee. Have a seat. Make yourself comfortable, put yourself on the record, and we'll listen to your statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kate Burkhart, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board. I'm also the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Today, I'm just wearing my Mental Health Board hat. And I'd like to speak to you about why the Mental Health Board supports this bill and the protection it affords to their unique constituency. According to the Department of Justice, individuals with a disability, whether it be physical or cognitive, are 2 to 3 times more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. Add to that the fact that they are often some of our most vulnerable neighbors. The fact that crimes do happen against individuals with disabilities solely on the basis of that disability leads us to believe that this additional protection is appropriate. The Department of Justice, when it reports crimes that are motivated based on feelings of hate toward different suspect classes, report that crimes against individuals with disabilities are in the minority. Most crimes that would be considered hate crimes occur on the basis of race and then religious or faith affiliations and then gender. However, of the number of people that report being the victim of a crime motivated by bias against disability, three-quarters are because of a mental health or a cognitive disability. So while we're the minority of the folks that suffer this kind of victimization, individuals experiencing a mental illness are often disproportionately represented. The Department of Justice also reports that half of those individuals report multiple disabilities, compounding their vulnerability. And so having the state of Alaska prioritize their protection is something that we support. It's also important from an education and policymaking standpoint. At the national level, the National Council on Disability, the National Center for Victims of Crime, and the Association of University Centers on Disability have called for increased public education and policy changes to prevent victimization of individuals with disabilities. And we feel that this bill goes a long way towards achieving those goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burkhart. I don't see any questions. Also here in Juneau is Kelly Birkinshaw. Hi, Kelly. Come forward, have a seat, make yourself comfortable, put yourself on the record, and we'll listen to your testimony.
My name is Kelly Birkinshaw, and I serve on the board of Alaskans Together for Equality with Shale Hutchison. I couldn't have said it any better than Shale said, so I will not go on at length, but as a member of a board that advocates for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights, we would like to thank the chair and chair members for hearing this bill and would encourage you to pass the bill through as quickly as possible. Do you have any questions?
I don't see any. That's good and to the point.
Thank you.
Thank you for your statement. Appreciate you being here today. Now let's turn back to the off-nets. We have Jeff Mittman signed up to testify. Mr. Mittman, can you hear me?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. And to extend briefly on our comments and our written testimony, again, we would like to thank Senator Davis, the bill sponsor, and her staff for their work in bringing this bill forward. We appreciate their efforts in ensuring that all Alaskans are treated fairly and equally and are protected. We think it's an important piece of legislation, and we're very gratified to see that this year gender identity has been included. We know by statistics that transgender individuals are targeted for violence. As commented on by Senator McGuire, it's important, however, to balance these protections with First Amendment speech and associational rights. While the ACLU certainly does not support repugnant speech or endorse hateful language or groups, it is incumbent under the Constitution for us to protect those rights. Individuals have the right in the United States to say hurtful and hateful things. And the bill, as currently drafted without the additional protections, is susceptible to a facial challenge in that it chills free speech. As we know, the Supreme Court and courts generally are very protective of First Amendment rights. And this bill, as written, we fear, could be subject to a facial challenge as it could be construed to chill those associational rights without the limiting language. We don't think the limiting language would harm the bill in any respect, as it would not limit the ability to bring prosecutions. It would make it clear, however, that the evidence must relate to the commission of the crime, and we hope that the committee will work with the Department of Law, with the sponsor, and with the drafters to make these simple modifications. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. I see Senator Paskin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. You know, there was previous comments about increased attacks on homeless in Alaska. Is it your understanding that that would fit within one of these classifications that are identified in this bill?
To the extent, through the chair, Senator Pressman, to the extent that a homeless individual may have been targeted based on race or, for example, a mental or physical disability, clearly they would be covered. Absent that, given the current language, there may not be coverage. So, for example, if there were a homeless person who were of a majority race and not suffering from any disability, they potentially could be left out of these protections.
Follow-up?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. My question is, we have had this bill come before the legislature in various forms over the years. This is the first time I have heard your organization raise concerns regarding First Amendment issues, associational rights. Can you comment on that? Is this something that's I'll just leave it to you. You can comment on that if you would, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe actually in the last legislature, in fact, I think I was present in Juneau when this was before the committee, and at that time we had raised some of the issues. Our testimony last session was to include gender identity, which again has been accomplished, but we did have the First Amendment concerns, and I'd be happy to forward to the committee our written testimony from the last session. This is an ongoing concern, and I think it's most instructive that, as noted in our testimony, at the federal level, the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Act does make explicit, because of these associational and free speech issues, that the evidence must be carefully limited.
Mr. Mimmond, thank you. And Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Jeff. Always good to hear from you. Do you believe that the current statute is unconstitutional then, since we don't have that language in there?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's an interesting question. And two answers. One, as currently drafted, the protections are currently in AS 1255-155, the aggravators. There is not a current, as we understand it and have read the statutes, there's not a current hate crimes section. It's currently in the aggravators. I suppose potentially how the aggravating evidence was introduced could be susceptible to an as-applied challenge, given, though, that this new bill creates the crime of motivation by prejudice, it raises concerns to a higher level, if that answers the question.
Follow-up.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the language that you're recommending, and, for instance, the current statute says it's against the law to discriminate against someone because of their race. And what you're suggesting is we add a section that evidence of expression or associations of the defendant may not be introduced. So in that particular case, you couldn't introduce the fact that someone was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, for instance. And I would think that would be a relevant piece of evidence in a racial discrimination case.
Through the chair. Again, in terms of the aggravating evidence, the language of AS 1255 establishes that if the defendant knowingly directs conduct because of that person's race, it could potentially allow, for example, introduction of associational and First Amendment rights. And again, we believe that introduction on its own is susceptible to an as-applied challenge on First Amendment grounds. For example, it's interesting that there's an exception for impeachment evidence. So, for example, a defendant would not be allowed to state, I have no bias whatsoever, and open the door to evidence, well, in fact, that they do have bias. But we believe that the language passed in the federal legislation finds the balance appropriately, allowing a prosecutor to introduce necessary evidence to establish the elements of the crime, but not allowing it so broadly as to be susceptible to a constitutional challenge.
Further questions? Interesting issue, another one we'll be pondering, I'm sure, in the committee. Thank you, Mr. Mittman. Last up to testify is Wanda Green. Wanda Green, if you can hear me, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
This is Wanda Green, president of the NAACP.
Welcome.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? Am I too loud?
No, you're just right.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm calling because I am in favor of and in support of Senator Davis's and Senator Davis's bill in Senate Bill Number 11. As you probably know, nationally, and I happen to know this as well, as the NAACP was definitely in 100% support of the U.S. Senate passage of the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Part of the NAACP's mission is to ensure social and economic equality for all citizens, to achieve equality of rights. Definitely, like I just said, to seek enactment and enforcement of federal, state, and local laws securing civil rights. And, again, just to achieve equality and rights and eliminate race prejudice among the citizens, not only of the United States, but also of our community here in Anchorage, Alaska, and our state in Alaska. The NAACP nationally has definitely backed social issues like this, legislation to eliminate discrimination wherever you may find it, whether it be sexual orientation, your race, physical or mental disability, sexual orientation, and as I'm pleased to see, as other people had mentioned earlier, the gender identity, ancestry, or national origin. So I was very pleased to see that, and I just wanted to go on record saying that the local NAACP, in line with the national NAACP, supports Senate Bill Number 11.
Ms. Green, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any question. Is there anyone else online who wants to testify about SB 11? Anyone else online? Anyone else here in the room wants to testify on SB 11? Don't hear or see anyone. And so with that, I'm going to close public testimony. The bill does have some interesting nuances. We will hold it over to let committee members ponder it and see what we decide to do about limiting some of the evidentiary issues associated with it. And with that, we'll turn to the last bill we have up today, which is SB 39. For those who may be watching, this is my bill on the U.S. My and Senator McGuire's bill on the U.S. Presidential Election Compact. For those who may be watching and listening to the progress of this bill, I know there are many folks who want to testify for, many who want to testify against. I did not think we would have time to get to public testimony today, and indeed, I don't. We still don't. But we will make certain that when we do get to that point in the proceeding, that we have noticed that adequately so the world can have its chance to weigh in on this bill while it's here in this committee. So with that, SB 39 is in front of us. I neglected to read the sponsor statement at the last committee hearing, and I usually like to do that. So I'm going to go ahead and read it into the record. If committee members will indulge me. Senate Bill 39. If there is one bedrock rule in elections, it is this: the person with the most votes is the winner. This legislation would guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the most votes in the United States. The concept of the person with the most votes wins is simple, but it hasn't always worked out that way in our presidential elections. In 1876, Samuel Tilden received 254,000 more votes than Rutherford Hayes. However, Hayes won the Electoral College tally by one vote by having won a number of states by a very small margin. In 1888, Grover Cleveland led in the popular vote over Benjamin Harrison, 48.6% to 47.8%, but Harrison won the Electoral College by a 233-168 margin, largely by virtue of his 1% win in Cleveland's home state of New York. In 2000, we all remember that Al Gore won the popular vote by just over 500,000 votes, but lost in the Electoral College to George Bush, 266-271. And again in 2004, a shift of only 60,000 votes in Ohio from George Bush to John Kerry would have resulted in Kerry winning the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote by over 3 million votes. SB 39 corrects this defect in our presidential elections, not by doing away with the Electoral College, but by modifying how each state's electoral votes are cast. Currently, the state's Electoral College votes are cast 100% in favor of the popular vote winner in the state. The bill would have Alaska join a compact made up of states that have pledged to cast their electoral votes in favor of the national popular vote winner. The compact would not go into effect until enough states have joined to put a majority of the Electoral College votes in the compact. The choice of how to allocate our vote within the Electoral College is given to us by Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. The founding fathers of our country left the decision on how to select electors up to each individual state legislature. The U.S. Supreme Court has written that the appointment and mode of appointment of electors belong exclusively to the states under the Constitution of the United States. Many believe the current system causes candidates to focus on swing states and swing state issues instead of approaching the country as a whole. It is beyond dispute that under the current system, candidates spend their campaign funds on just a few states. Here's an example of how this plays out in Alaska. During the last 40 days of the 2008 election, 99% of all media expenditures were made in 17 states. Alaska, needless to say, was not one of them. In a close presidential election that decides our country's future, all states should be swing states. Every vote should count and should be sought by every candidate. This bill will promote truly national presidential campaigns, and it will ensure that the person sent to occupy the most powerful office in the world is the one who got the most votes in the election. I'll just say a couple of comments on the bill. It was a surprise to me to learn that the method of awarding electoral votes has changed quite substantially over the years. It used to be done just by state. For example, when we elected George Washington, our president, in 1789, only a few of the Electoral College electors were actually selected by election. Most were just assigned by the state legislatures because of the language in the U.S. Constitution. I think as state legislatures, we sometimes feel like we're like second-class citizens in the world of, Congress being the more dominant players. But we do get mentioned specifically in the U.S. Constitution in this provision. We, as state legislators, are the sole arbiters of how electoral votes are awarded, and it just was something interesting that I learned in preparing this bill. It really is about making sure that the person who gets the most votes wins on a national level. There's lots of sort of internal rationalization that you undergo as you consider this bill about whether it helps Alaska or hurts Alaska, whether it increases our influence or decreases it, whether it makes us more Democratic or more Republican. And in my view, that's all sort of secondary to making certain that the Electoral College awards the presidency to the person who got the most votes. And this bill, absent some action by the United States Congress to undo the Electoral College, this is a way to go about it. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions. I know two of you at least have seen this in an earlier committee, but I'm happy to answer questions from the committee, and then we'll get a sectional overview from my staff. Seeing and hearing no questions at the moment, Senator Coghill.
You know, during the discussion, I'll probably ask some questions, but I think at this point, just an overview.
An overview? Sure. If Mr. Motorow would come forward then, he will walk us through the sections of the bill. Please put yourself on the record and give us the sectional.
Thank you, Chair French and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Motorow, and I'm staff to Senator French. I'm going to walk through the bill line by line, and if you have questions along the way, feel free to stop me. To begin, this legislation adds new sections to AS 1530, which pertains to national elections in our state. Starting out on page 1, lines 9 through 13, this provides that Alaska joins this compact with the other states that enact it. Moving on to Article 1 of the compact, which starts on the bottom of page 1 and then continues through page 2, line 2, it outlines that any state and the District of Columbia may join in this compact. Article 2 of the compact, page 2, lines 3 through 6, requires that a member state conduct a statewide popular election for president and vice president. Article 3 of the compact discusses how electors are selected under the compact language. Page 2, lines 9 through 14, require member states to calculate the national popular vote total for each presidential slate. Page 2, line 15 through 16, requires that state election officials, and in this case, the director of our Division of Election, designate the national popular vote winner. Page 2, lines 17 through 19, requires the presidential elector or certifying official in Alaska to certify the appointment of the winning candidate's electoral slate. Page 2, lines 20 through 24, require that member states communicate state vote totals at least 6 days before presidential electors meet and cast their votes. This is a federal law also put into the compact. Page 2, lines 25 through 28, require member states to treat as conclusive an official statement containing the number of popular votes in a state for each presidential slate on the day currently required by a law for states to make that final determination. Again, that's currently a federal law that is reiterated in the compact. Page 2, line 29 through page 3, line 1, makes it clear that in the case of a tie, states vote for the candidate who received the popular vote in their state alone. Page 3, lines 2 through 7, outline procedures in case the number of presidential electors nominated in a member state do not equal the number that the state is entitled to. Page 3, lines 8 through 9 require public disclosure of vote totals as they are determined or obtained. Page 3, lines 10 through 12 require that this compact govern the appointment of presidential electors if it is active on July 20th of a presidential election year. Then we move on to Article 4, which contains other provisions. Page 3, lines 14 to 16 sets when this compact becomes active. And that is when, as Senator French mentioned in the overview of the bill, when a majority of Electoral College votes are governed by the compact. Page 3, lines 17 through 20, allow for any state to withdraw from this compact, but not during the final 6 months of a president's term. This lines up with the July 20th date I just spoke about. And the reason for that blackout is to provide for set election procedures going into the election season. If a state decides to change whether or not they are part of this compact and they want to withdraw, they must do so and notify other states, as lines 21 through 24 provide in the bill. Page 3, line 25 terminates this compact if the Electoral College is terminated. And page 3, lines 26 through 27 severs different components of this act if one portion is struck down. Moving along, the compact provides in Article 5 different definitions. Just to highlight a few of them, A on page 3, line 29 to 31, clarifies who the chief election official is. This is our director of the Division of Elections. And page 4, lines 8 through 10, discusses who certifies the appointment of presidential electors. Again, under our current statutes, this is the director of the Division of Elections. Page 4, lines 22 through 24, declare our director in that role. Section 2 of the bill adjusts our current statutes, AS 153060, which relate to the notification of electors, to adapt once this compact becomes activated. Section 3 of the bill, page 4 at the very bottom through page 5, line 9, adds a new subsection to that statute. It requires electors to be notified as outlined by the compact and not by the current law. Again, our current law stays in effect until this compact is passed by enough states. Section 4 does a similar type switch with the duties of the elector statute. Again, Section 4 provides for the switch once enough states have joined in, and 5 clarifies that electoral duties are governed by the compact and not current statutes at that time. And that concludes the overview. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Motoro. You're like a Swiss watch. It is exactly 3 o'clock. So I will ask the committee to hold their questions to a future hearing, and that will, as I say, will be adequately noticed so that everybody knows it's coming. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, it's 3 o'clock, and we are adjourned.